on to your hats. We've got an interview coming up here that hopefully is going to shed a lot of light on some of the issues that I've been putting up on the website here. More specifically, we have a gentleman here who has several decades of research and efforts being placed by him to expose the criminality within this Zionist, Illuminati. We got a lot of names for this stuff, but World Zionism and Rothschild conspiracy is the one I'd like to call it. His name is Eustace Mullins. He's been attacked by everybody, front, right, and center. And, geez, you know something, Eustace? I can understand how that feels, boy, because they're attacking me right now like you have no idea.
Well, when they come after you, they give you everything they got.
Well, they have been. I get it from both sides. I get it from other websites and people. It's fine because obviously I'm making a difference or they wouldn't be doing it.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, here's the interesting thing. I mean, I've been reading Benjamin Friedman's work, and you knew Ben Friedman, and he spent a great deal of his own money and a lot of time on trying to get people to pay attention to these issues, and he was not very successful because he couldn't get the airplay he wanted, and so his tape, record that he made kind of fell by the wayside over the years, the 1961 interview and that he did over in a Washington hotel. It's resurfaced, and it is powerful in what it talks about and how these people manipulated the last century to create war, famine, destruction, enmity, and criminality throughout our world. And I want to know what your personal relationship was with Mr. Friedman, and was he as credible as I think he was?
Oh, he was absolutely credible. In fact, his work has lasted. That is a great test of all, the test of time. And I see more Friedman stuff around now than when he was alive.
Well, he deserves a lot. If you know, most of the things that I've been able to check on, and I can't check on everything, but everything that I have checked on seems to check out. And
oh, it does. Ben was a real scholar.
Well, he did.
He was an intellectual.
Yeah, he did a good job. And here's what he said. He was there in the 1916 meeting with Untermeyer and I guess who else did he send? Baruch and Morgenthau and a whole group of very, very high placed Jews from New York City and across the country to come to Britain and convince them that if they fought for a homeland in Palestine after World War I, they would get America committed to the World War I fight. And that seems to make sense to me and anybody who looks at it. What's your take on all that?
Well, it was quite a movement to get America into the war. You say America was isolationist, had no interest in the European war. And it didn't look like they were going to get into World War I. And if World War I would have been a total bust if they had gotten America into it, because it would have been a small local war in Europe, it wouldn't have done any good at all for the conspirators. So they had to get us in, and Woodrow Wilson is the man that they chose to do it.
Well, I hear that Justice Brandeis may well have had a hand in blackmailing him. There is some evidence of that. I haven't seen it personally. What do you know about that?
Oh, yes, the Peck letters. You see, they blackmailed Wilson into appointing Judge Brandeis on the Supreme Court. And Justice Brandeis was also the head of the World Zionist Organization. So you know where his real sympathies lay. So after Brandeis got in, he opened the door for Bernard Baruch to become Wilson's czar of the War Industries Board. Baruch had total control over every industrialist in the United States. He boasted in 1932, testifying before Congress, that he had more power than any person in the history of the United States.
Bernard Baruch, they named the City University of New York after him, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, the Bernard Baruch Business College.
That's right, they did. It was right up the street from my university, and I remember that. Anyway, here's the interesting thing. They didn't stop there. In the 30s, what they found out was that they hadn't sufficiently destroyed Germany, and the terms of surrender after World War I didn't seem to be painful enough because the Germans were onto their little scheme, according to Mr. Friedman. So what they decided to do was create an economic boycott against Germany that forced the nation almost into starvation in the early 30s. Am I correct?
Oh, that's correct. You see, World War I and World War II were caused solely by the fact that Great Britain couldn't compete with German quality. And that was driving Great England off the world market. So England faced their economic collapse. They had to destroy Germany, and it took them two world wars to do it. And now Germany is under complete control. Germany, the nation of Germany today is ruled by the German Marshall Plan out of New York City. Germany has had no government since 1945.
And it's still this way, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Well, here's the interesting thing. What they said was the German people actually caught wind of this conspiracy and felt some personal enmity toward Jews, but they did not strike out against them, did they?
No, indeed. In fact, George Sylvester used to tell me a joke. He said there was during the 1920s, there was a long parade through Berlin of Nazis carrying the signs, "Down with the Jews, down with the Jews." And at the end of the program, at the end of the parade came two Jewish bankers who were paying for the whole thing, Max Warburg and Max Oppenheimer. And so they carried signs, "Down with us."
Down with us.
Oh, very kind of great sense of humor. Europeans do have a good sense of humor. They have much more humor about politics than we do.
Well, the bottom line was that the buildup after the 1932-33 battle for the chancellery, which, of course, Hitler was able to take from he killed his way into it, from what I understand. But he was financed, his war machine, his buildup, was financed by these bankers, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Max Warburg and Max Oppenheimer financed everything. And they put out a mythical story that German industrialists had financed Hitler, which wasn't true. The German industrialists didn't like him and had nothing to do with him. All of his money came from Jewish bankers, which created a paradoxical situation that you had an anti-Semitic government, which was attacking the Jews, and it was all financed with Jewish money.
Well, now, at the time, was anybody aware over the, you know, was this above board, or was this kind of clandestine financing?
Oh, this was clandestine. In fact, Aldi came into it years later after World War II. George Sylvester Beard told me a lot of it. See, he was the illegitimate son of Kaiser Wilhelm I.
Who was?
George Sylvester Beard. He represented Germany during both World Wars. I used to kid him that he cost Germany victory in both World Wars, and he was quite flattered when I told him that.
And was he from the same Zionist camp?
Oh, no, he was old European aristocracy.
Ah, okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, I got a few other questions about Mr. Friedman. Anyway, then I want to move over to Mr. Untermyer as well as Mr. Fagan. Ladies and gentlemen, when we return, we have a great resource in Eustace Mullins. Stick with us. And ladies and gentlemen, we're back. Darryl Bradford Smith, your host today. Got a great interview going on, but give you my details here. IamTheWitness.com is the website. And these subjects we're talking about are all available on that site, including Benjamin Friedman, Samuel Untermyer's transcript, as well as Myron Fagan's work. We're going to go back to Ben Friedman's work here. He talks about World War II, the destruction and all of the things that happened in World War II, being designed in order to get an exodus of the Jewish community from Europe. In other words, there was no event that was going to get them to migrate to the Middle East, to Palestine, and that these people, these megalomaniacs in charge, came up with a scheme that by having this hatred generated against the Jewish community, somehow they would get an exodus of this community, and by and large, it worked, didn't it?
Oh, yes. In fact, Hitler was recruited by the World Zionist Organization in 1923. He had this whole movement in Germany that wasn't going anywhere, and the World Zionist Organization cut a deal with him in 1923. They joined and worked together, and that's how the Nazi Party was created. So you see, the Holocaust itself was created entirely in the Jewish community. The rest of the world had no problem with Jewish people whatsoever.
Well, their goal, though, was to get a population of them to get back into Palestine and then to exercise that Balfour agreement they had made with the British so that a homeland could be established. To what end was this being done? Why were they trying to set up this homeland, Eustace, in your view?
Well, they figured this homeland was at the crossroads of the world, and that it would control the entire world. That's what it was about. It was about world domination. They weren't just looking for a homeland for the Jewish people. They were looking to dominate the world. You could do it from the crossroads of the world in Palestine.
Are there religious overtones to this?
I have never found any religious overtones in everything. Everything is practical politics. Everybody's after money and power. I haven't run into religious people at all.
You haven't, but they do use religion as a smokescreen, don't they?
Well, they always use religion. Religion is a perfect smokescreen because you could say whatever you're doing for God, and who could criticize you for that?
Well, that seems to be what's happened then.
Oh, yeah, and, exactly what happened.
Well, and I also understand that there are nonsensical ideas that they want to reestablish the Temple Mount after they've consolidated their power in the Middle East.
They certainly do. All those plans are in that formation right now.
They are.
Oh, yes.
And to reestablish that Temple Mount, to who welcomed the Rothschilds to the leadership role in that area?
Well, the Rothschilds had the leadership role in that area since 1880. The whole idea of a Jewish homeland in Palestine was financed by the Rothschilds from Vienna in 1880. See, there was never a penny put up by the Jewish community itself for settling in Palestine because the Jews were very happy in Europe. They had no reason to go to Palestine. If you're living in a beautiful modern city, why would you want to go live in a desert? I mean, they're not crazy.
Well, that makes sense. And a desert, in fact, that is being fought over.
Oh, yes. Still being fought over because it's still the crucial area of the world. You control Europe and Asia from that area.
Yeah.
So geopolitically, it makes sense. It doesn't make sense from economic sense. It does make sense even from geography. You have to know geopolitical goals in order to understand what's going on with that. And the American people have no concept of geopolitics whatsoever.
Yeah, that's pretty evident. Now let's go to Myron Fagan's work here. He actually does a chronology or a timeline, as it were, for what he describes, not Zionism. He describes it more as the Illuminati or these Council on Foreign Relations, but aren't these just creations of the same Zionist leadership?
Oh, yes. The Illuminati and Freemasons all came out of the Rothschilds in Vienna, Austria. And, Myron was trying to focus on the conspiratorial angle of the thing. He was a very brilliant man and one of the finest people I ever met in my life. He was the only person for years who would promote my Federal Reserve book, which appeared in 1953, and was really immediately in the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith unleashed a national campaign against the book. They labeled it as virulently anti-Semitic and myself as the worst anti-Semite in history. So they've never quit. They're still saying what they said in 1953. That my book is anti-Semitic, and people read it, pick it up and read it, they can't find an anti-Semitic word in it, so it really puzzles them. But Byron went against the whole establishment because he was an honest man, and he believed in what he was doing, and he did it all his life. I knew him in his last years. He had finally left California for New York, and he was living in a one-room place in New York in a poor section, and his home was broken into almost every day.
Well, here's the next question. I mean, we're looking at this, at his work, and at Mr. Friedman's work. Now, there are some inconsistencies, but they have more to do with maybe events that didn't happen as predicted, but not necessarily the veracity of it all. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about your relationship with Mr. McCarthy in the 50s. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, Eustace is going to talk about Joseph McCarthy, and was this man on the money or was he not? Back. We've got a short segment here before our top of the hour break. There, Eustace, you'll have a couple of minutes to get a cup of tea or something at the top of the hour. But before we go to that break, I want to ask you a couple of questions here. About Ezra Pound, what happened to Ezra, and what did they try to do to this man? They really tried to crush him. And what's the significance of his work in this whole thing?
Well, you know, Ezra was a completely free agent. He was belonged to no political party. And never espoused any kind of political feeling in his life. He was loyal to the Constitution of the United States, and he maintained his American citizenship. And all the years he lived in Italy, he was a loyal American. And that's how they indicted him for treason, because he was a loyal American. If he'd given up his American citizenship, they could never have touched him.
Well, what were the reasons for indicting him?
He was indicted by Alger Hiss, who was a specialist in treason. See, he was a personal assistant to Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was a KGB agent. And Ezra was quite anti-communist in those days, which most everybody was. I was, too. And he was very critical of the communist slave system. So,
well, communism is a fabrication of this group in order to de-godify the population or de-religify the population, if there is such a word, and also to make people believe that there is no difference between the effort of one as opposed to another, thereby destroying anybody's personal drive in life, and it's a disastrous philosophy that they invented, isn't it?
It's totally invented. In fact, the Rothschilds invented Zionism, fascism, Nazism, and communism, all in 1830 in Germany. And it's not a dime's worth of difference between any of them.
Well, when we talk about this left-right difference in our political system and all the fighting that's going on, what Myron Fagan talks about is that these are fights that they propagate in order to keep people separated from each other so that no one ever fights the real fight, which is the haves against the have-nots and the powerful elite against the sheeple, the slaves down below. And that is still very much in force, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. In fact, this talk about left and right is total nonsense. It never has been anything but nonsense. I have never met an extreme right-wing person in the United States, unless he was a double agent posing as an extreme right-wing person, which is usually the case.
Well, but now what we've got here is they also do this with races. They do it between blacks and
religion,
Jews and blacks and whites.
Absolutely.
And so
these are created out of nothing. Why, here in the South, before 1940, blacks and whites got along very well together. But all of this was created after World War II, the so-called schism between blacks and white people in the South. It has the Ku Klux Klan, which is a Masonic organization, the Grand Kleagle and all that, these are Masonic terms. And that was created to drive a wedge between blacks and whites all throughout this country, and it still exists.
Yes, it does. I'd like to talk a little bit when we come back after the break about Albert Pike as well.
Oh, yes.
And some of his the letters from Albert Pike that are claimed to be possible forgeries. When we return, ladies and gentlemen, that we've got a six-minute break. We've got lots more from Eustace Mullins. Please stick with the French Connection. Anyway, we've been talking with Eustace Mullins here, and Eustace is, everyone that's been studying the subjects that I've been talking about for some time on my site has to defer to much of the work that Eustace has put together over time and his relationship to the people who also fought the fight with him. What we're doing today is discussing some of those people from the past that are no longer with us and getting Eustace's take on their efforts and the things that they put together, as well as some of the bad guys that he faced at that time. One of the people that you worked with, Eustace, in your early years was Joseph McCarthy. And Joe McCarthy was a, well, he was onto the truth, wasn't he? And boy, did they lambaste him toward the middle part of his effort to expose these people.
Well, that's absolutely true. You see, Washington had become a place where everybody knew what was going on, but nobody talked about it, and everybody accepted that situation until Joe came along as a Wisconsin farm boy from upstate Wisconsin, and Joe was horrified by what was going on in Washington. He started talking about it.
Well, I mean, what led him to this nest? Where did he get his information from when Joe was doing his research?
Well, when Joe came to Washington, he was a farm boy, and so he was picked up by the insiders, and his three mentors became J. Edgar Hoover, Father Walsh of the Georgetown Foreign School of Service, and George Sikorsky, a Russian communist Bolshevik from Vladivostok.
Now, those were his mentors.
Those were his mentors. Joe didn't know a thing about anything, and they told him what they wanted to hear. And they created his anti-communist crusade out of nothing.
They did. They wanted the crusade to take place.
Absolutely.
Why?
Because it was focusing on little Jewish shoemakers and people like that, and it totally ignoring the world banking forces behind these dictatorships like Germany and Italy and so forth.
So they threw some low-level Jews to the dogs and to kind of dissipate the vitriol and the anger against what they were doing.
Oh, definitely. And so the first couple of years that Joe was in Washington, that's all he knew was what Sikorsky and Jared Groover told him.
Wow. And so, and then he was set up to be taken down.
Not quite that fast. See, a friend of mine was working for him, George Westinghouse Kiles, and we were good friends. We had lunch together on Capitol Hill every day. So Kiles told me that, he said, would you do some work for Joe McCarthy? And I said, well, what would he want me to do? He said, he would just like for you to do a little research for him. So I went to the Library of Congress and prepared a 40-page report giving the entire financial background of world communism, which is anti-capitalist, by the way. I mean, their so-called philosophy is anti-capitalist. Well, it was all bankers' money. And so this 40-page report that I prepared for Joe told the entire background of world communism. It was Wall Street bankers and Swiss bankers and London bankers, and that was it. There was ever a working class person associated with the communist movement. So Kyle took that to Joe, and he was really excited about it. It opened the world up to him for the first time in his life. So he took that speech and flew to Chicago and gave a speech at the Union Club, the top people in Chicago, and they went wild. And so he came back. He was on top of the world. And he had a lot of support. He was getting 25,000 letters a day from the American people. They were so gratified that at last somebody had told them what communism was. Mm-hmm. So he was overnight the most popular politician in American history, and it looked like he was going to take over the whole town single-handed. And they were scared. I mean, they were terrified. So that's when they started working on him. And they got a counterpart composed of Richard Nixon and Senator Cabot from Washington, from Massachusetts.
Henry Cabot Lodge?
Henry Cabot Lodge. The Lodge family and Richard Nixon and a couple other insiders, and they plotted Joe's downfall. They created this fake reprimand, which destroyed Joe completely. And what they accused him of was criticizing Democrats. That was the offense for which Joe was driven out of Washington.
For criticizing Democrats. Not for criticizing communism like they say today.
No. He was not really criticizing communism that much, but because he knew the background of communism as the first person in Washington who had ever heard the true background of communism. And it blew his mind. Well, when Ezra Pound told me about it in Salem in 1948, it blew my mind.
Ezra put who in the insane asylum? Ezra was in the insane asylum.
Yeah, you see, they accused him of treason, but they couldn't, they had no basis for that charge, so they couldn't try him. So they said he was incompetent to participate in his own defense, and they had three government psychiatrists commit him to St. Elizabeth's.
And see, how long did they keep him there?
They kept him about 13 and a half years, but he was supposed to spend the rest of his life there, because people on Capitol Hill swore that Ezra Pound would die in St. Elizabeth. He'd never be freed during his lifetime. And when I met Pound, he told me, he said, I want the government to drop the charges, and I'll walk out a free man. And I really thought he was crazy then, because there was no chance of that. But 10 years later, he walked out a free man.
Wow. So they're willing to do whatever it takes to protect themselves from being exposed.
Absolutely. When they go after an enemy, they'll destroy you by any means that they can. And if one thing doesn't work, they'll try something else. And money is no object.
I'm beginning to experience this now.
I've been up against it for 60 years. I know what it's like, and they do. They'll spend thousands of dollars for agents who infiltrate you and destroy your operation.
Well, my operation is me, so what are they going to do to infiltrate me other than to try to destroy me from outside? And truth is they're spinning like lie after lie, and they're coming from all kinds of different places, including people that most people would never think would do that.
Oh, yeah.
That's the honest thing, Eustace. They're coming from places you don't believe that they would ever come from.
Well, that shows that they're desperate, you see. They're going to keep on. When they're desperate, they try harder than ever. I'm not offering you a very good prospect there.
No, that doesn't sound like a solution there, Eustace. Yeah, here, I want to go on to another fellow here that's very instrumental in this because he never did turn sides. He was always on the bad guy's side. His name is Untermyer.
Oh, Sammy Untermyer, yeah.
Yeah, and he was as tied into this as you can get. And he did a 1933 speech, boy, that I've got the transcript on my website here. It is very powerful in the way he uses the lie of the day to explain to his constituency within the Jewish Zionist community. When we come back, ladies and gentlemen, I want to ask Eustace about this gentleman, Untermyer, this guy, this crazy man here, and see what we can't put together about him when we return on The French Connection. Ladies and gentlemen, we are back with our special guest today, Eustace Mullins. Eustace is he's a real resource, and he's a first-person witness to much of what we're discussing today, and the names and times of early on in this fight against world Zionism. It's been around for hundreds of years in its present manifestations, but it has its roots over the millennia almost. I mean, these folks have been fermenting problems dating back to as far back as the Spanish Inquisition and before, haven't they?
Oh, yes, indeed. There's nothing new here because their plans have never changed over the centuries. They remained consistent and committed to their plans, that they're going to go ahead with them regardless of anything.
Boy, you know, now how does Mr. Untermyer figure into all these activities?
Well, he was a key financial and lawyer to the big bankers in New York City. He put together deals for Bernard Baruch and the Rothschilds. He merged some of the biggest companies in the United States. And he charged enormous fees, $2 or $3 billion a fee. And he became a multimillionaire many times over. He lived like a king. He had 60 gardeners at his estate outside of New York City.
Jesus. Well, he comes back from his European visit in 1933, announcing to the Jewish group that was, the Zionist group that was meeting that day, that he was successful in beginning the the destruction of the German people, and that he was working on that boycott of their products. And yeah. Boy, he was venomous about what he wanted them to do.
Oh, he really was. He was a venomous person, and that was a declaration of war against Germany in 1933. So World War II was actually inaugurated by Samuel Unterberger in New York in 1933.
Yeah, that was the day that that the war was actually declared, wasn't it, against the German people?
That was war. That was a declaration of war.
Now, the fact that Hitler was stupid enough, or did he not, or did he know that he was making a deal with Stalin, not to have a non-aggression pact, and then turned around and went against that? Why? They were both being supported by the same group. Stalin had his Zionist money supporters, and so did Hitler.
Well, because anybody that these people support, they support you in a given territory, but you cannot encroach on somebody else's territory. You see, when Hitler invaded Russia in June 1941, it was to stop Stalin from invading Germany in 1941, because Stalin had already committed all of his troops to attack Germany in September of 41.
So Barbarossa was a plan to beat Stalin to the attack.
That's right. It was a blitzkrieg, which was intended to be launched before Stalin hit him. It was rival gangs fighting over the same territory.
And both of them being financed, again, two sides of a war being financed by the same megalomaniacs.
Oh, yes. Well, you cannot really have a war unless you finance both sides, because it's very hard to start wars. Most people don't want to go to war. And therefore, you have to finance two sides to get them to fight each other.
Is that happening in Iraq right now?
Oh, certainly. We were dealing with Iraq all along, you know. Saddam Hussein was on the CIA payroll for 40 years, and the Bushes supported him all the way.
Now, who's in charge of America right now? I know George Bush and family are just underlings of these people.
Oh, yeah, they're lackeys. I used to tell people that the Rothschilds financed the Harrimans in the Union Pacific Railroad, and they financed John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil. So they were just puppets of the Rothschilds.
And they're not even way up on the food chain, are they?
Oh, no. In fact, I don't think they participate in the important councils at all. They just do what they're told.
Uh-huh. And who are some of the others that are doing it today in our country?
Well, it's the old families. You know, there's five Italian families that have controlled the papacy since 1825. The Medici had three or four other families. They're well known in Italy.
But who's in control of the United States right now, Eustace?
Well, when you look at it, it almost looks like nobody is in control. The American people certainly are in control. They're totally out of control.
Well, but I mean, what families right now are controlling the strings?
Well, it's right out of Europe and the Rothschilds. But the families they're using here are the Schiffs and the Warburgs and the Rockefellers and people like that.
And how about the Goldmans and the Lehmans and the Kahn and
They're all Wall Street stooges, that's all they are. They're just brokers on Wall Street. They don't have any real power. They make a lot of money. They make $100 billion a year apiece, but they don't really have any power. No, the decisions are made from higher up.
And the higher up is between Warburg and Rothschild.
Oh, that's exactly right. You're talking business now.
And those families intermarry, don't they?
They do. They intermarry constantly. And in fact, they are more conscious of marriages than the royal families of Europe. Any marriage between members of those families is a business merger. That's all it is.
Really? And who is the lead component of that family today?
The lead component?
Of the Rothschild fortune. Is it the British part of it?
The British who?
There are three parts of the family. Some of them live in Zurich, some live in London, and some live in France.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're pretty well evenly matched. For quite a few years, 1920 to 1940, the Rothschilds were financed by the British, or were controlled by the French branch. But they're out of power now. They were controlled after that by the London base. I think it's still being run out of London.
And are those, is that the same guy that this Edward there that you see pictures of Governor Schwarzenegger there standing beside and Warren Buffett taking pictures with? Is that the guy that's in charge?
It was. For a long time, there was a guy named Goldsmith, Jimmy Goldsmith, but he died. And I don't know exactly who's running the show right now.
Well, it seems to me all the intermarriage would start affecting their intellect. Is that happening?
Well, it probably does, and it probably has. They don't particularly show any intellect. They're just doing the same thing over and over again. They're not coming out with anything new. And that's why they're so predictable.
But how the heck do they get away with it so cleverly? I mean, how do they do it?
Well, they
how come the public can't get their brains around this problem?
Well, because they've got control of capital, they've got control of the seats of power. And the public cannot get their foot in the door.
Have we ever had our foot in the door, ever?
Well, we've had our foot in the door a couple of times. We had it with Andrew Jackson, and we had it with people like Thomas Jefferson. There's been people who turned up sometimes that, that did some good. Now, Ezra Pound used to tell me that the last decent American president was Calvin Coolidge. He was a New England boy who became president. He was a very good president. But since then, it's all been downhill.
Oh, boy. Well, when we come back, we're going to have one more segment with Eustace, and we're going to discuss a couple of extra things that we have on our minds here today on The French Connection. When we return, more from Eustace Mullen.
Baby, do I feel high? Oh, me, oh, my.
And ladies and gentlemen, we're going to smooth our way right into this next long segment and then let my good friend Eustace Mullins go for his rest of his day in peace. Eustace, I want to talk to you about where we are in this fight and are we getting traction? I mean, I understand from my efforts that they are very worried about what I'm doing. There are many others waking up. I can tell you before I started fighting this particular part of the battle with Eric Hufschmidt, very few people could get away with talking about this without being completely mobbed by the ADL and the JDO.
Oh, that's true.
Now, we're actually getting traction, and more people are springing up everywhere, speaking about it, almost unopposed. Is that bizarre?
It's not bizarre. It's inevitable. They've been getting away with murder for years. They've been covering up all this criminal activity and hoodwinking the American people, who are portrayed absolutely been bamboozled into going like pack dogs after anybody that the Zionists want to sickle on. And I went through that over the last 60 years. You're going through it. But what happened was the Internet. And there's stuff coming out every day on the Internet that's really turning the world around.
And you think this is going to be their undoing, is the Internet?
Oh, it certainly is, because people are finding an outlet there, and they're deserting the media. They won't look at television, and I know people in Phoenix, Arizona, and Atlanta, Georgia, spend all day doing email, kind of corresponding with people. There's just a heck of a lot going on.
There is, isn't there?
Oh, there is.
Well, you know, they can shut the Internet down. What would that do to this movement? To communist Russia, and make it live behind closed walls like they did for China as well.
Well, I mean, that is exactly what they're doing.
Are they going to get away with it?
No, they won't get away with it, because people still have some desire to live. They're not all afflicted with the death wish. And people have been asking me at my lectures for 40 years, they say, when is the crash coming? When is the crash coming? Because they've been mind-conditioned to expect a crash.
Mm-hmm.
And so they prepare them for the crash. Whenever they ask me when the crash is coming, I'd say as soon as the government stops printing counterfeit money. Because this government, this economy, functions entirely on counterfeit money, and that's all that keeps it going from day to day. And without the counterfeit money, it would all crash tomorrow.
Well, what happens if the trading partners, such as China, no longer buy the treasury bills that they're printing for $3 billion a day, to finance their future debt? What happens if they say, no, we don't think that that's a very good purchase? What will happen?
Well, nobody is independent. These things are all controlled. China is just as controlled as the United States. So they'll keep on doing it as long as they're told to.
Do you think there is a goal that they will implode the place intentionally?
I don't know. If a racket is paying off, why would you close it down?
Hmm. So you're not predicting that they're going to try to implode the economy?
Not at all, because it's one thing to fix a horse race, but you don't go down and shoot all the horses. That doesn't solve anything.
Well, I see most of the businesses of any substance moving out of the country.
Oh, yeah.
I see most of the American public incapable today of holding any technical jobs because their education system has been so destroyed. And I don't see that the American economy is a place where anybody really feels comfortable making money anymore. It seems like they're gutting it, like they're destroying it from within.
Well, it's been gutted. It's been destroyed. I just came back from a month in Ohio, right in the heart of the Rust Belt at Toledo and Detroit. And what's going on is horrible. It's like the Depression in 1932.
Well, then why would you say that this is not an implosion intentionally?
It's an intentional explosion, but I think the American people will survive it. I think they have the will to survive. They don't know what's happening, but they're still not going to take it lying down.
Well, what would you suggest I do to get this message out farther afield, Eustace?
What you're doing is doing it. If you get the message out at all, you're winning. And if you're letting people know what's going on, I lectured for years to crowds as little as six or eight people. But I started a lot of fires that way, and those people today are still doing what they can to get this thing solved.
Well, I'm doing it because I woke up to the fact that I saw what our future was. And, well, worse than that, Eustace, I woke up finding out that everything I believed in was a lie.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a starting place for everybody. You realize it's all lies, and you got to start looking for the truth.
And boy, it's been a long, hard journey.
Oh, it's tough. I've been to the roof. When you start looking for the truth, the roof falls on you and on you. But if you survive that, you can keep going.
Well, you know, you would hope so until all the dogs are called out on you, Eustace, and you start getting worried and they pick through your rubbish can and stuff, you know?
Oh, yes. They might give you the full treatment.
Well, yeah, you know, I figured if they're looking through my rubbish, they're not ready to do me in. What they're willing to do is probably try to find ways to destroy me with what they find in my trash, I guess. I don't know.
Well, they use anything they can, and they won't quit either. That's the thing about it. They won't quit.
Well, I guess then I can't quit either.
You can't, because they force you to fight whether you want to fight or not.
Well, Eustace, do you have any suggestions for my listeners and what you would get them to get motivated to fight this further?
Well, you know, we're on the verge of a revolution right now. This country is about to have the biggest waking up since 1776, and it's going to come whether you want it or try to stop it or anything else, and it's on its way. America has always been the greatest country in the world, and it's amazing that the American people have survived all of the misery and lies and everything that they've been inundated with since 1900, but they're still going. The American people are still sound. It's an amazing situation.
So you're very hopeful then?
I'm very optimistic.
Well, good.
And being up at the Rust Belt in Ohio and in Michigan, which is a very depressing thing, it looks like a crash of 29 all over again.
Well, that's not very different than some parts of Massachusetts. If you go to Leominster and Lowell.
Terrible, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is happening throughout the nation, and, you know. Well, Eustace, I'm so happy you came on today. I didn't get to everything I wanted to ask you, but, you know, this is just one visit.
Oh, it is, but, you know, you never get to cover everything. After every program I do, I think the 50 things that I should have said.
Well, I'll have you back, sir, if you'll be willing to come.
Well, I'm right here.
Well, sir, I thank you again, and I will be in touch with you. We'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, after this break with some closing things. gentlemen, we're back. We're back, we're back. Let's talk a little bit about what else Mr. Myron Fagan spoke about here. It says, World War III is to be fomented using the so-called controversies by the agents of the Illuminati operating under whatever name that they are now being stored up between the political Zionists and the leaders of the Muslim world. The war is to be directed in such a manner that all of Islam and political Zionism will destroy each other, while at the same time remaining nations, once more divided in this issue, will be forced to fight themselves to a state of complete exhaustion, physical, mental, and spiritual, and economically. Well, I'm wondering to myself if that statement is not perfectly accurate, and I'm wondering also why, because this was in the early 60s, and what I do know about these people is that political reality on the ground often shifts the way they do their battling. It looks like instead of between Zionism and Muslims, the war that they've been fermenting has been between Christians and Muslims. That seems to be more about what they're doing. Now, it seems like Israel's trying to stay out of it, and the Jewish group that is involved. But as Eustace pointed out, these people are not terribly interested in his view of religion. They're more interested in power and control. And they want world domination. And that has been his experience for 60 years of doing this. Now, I kind of believe that that's probably true, although they do use this religious divide and these differences that people have in their faiths as ways of setting us up to be opponents to one another and working this double-sided paradigm continuously, as they did in Northern Ireland against Catholics and Protestants, as they're doing now between Shia and Sunni, between Democrat and Republican, between black and white, between every single kind of group that can be opposed to another. And you'll often find that these people are behind them in preparation for the next battle. For example, environmentalists against people who are capitalists. There's always a yin and yang battle being thrown at us, so that we will never discuss the real power structure behind these groups. And it seems to me that we're starting to become sophisticated enough to see through this. At least many of the people who've been studying this see through it. How do we make political capital ourselves on the fact that we do understand these political fights are nothing more than fabrications, and they're there to separate us from one another in order not that we won't fight the real villains in this battle? Of course, they have massive amounts of capital to employ against us. It's not too hard to find people willing to do things for money, sadly. Some people will even do things to get a book published. And, you know, when you see these kinds of behaviors, it makes it very, very difficult to understand how we're going to be able to coalesce around a single body, a single truth of these bad guys